And so to that end, I'd like to take some time to talk about the subject of context, Recently, for Christmas, my wife bought my four-year-old son a telescope from NASA. NASA has this brand of children telescopes that they are selling now. And so my son had been asking me for several days to put together his telescope so that he could watch the moon at night. And so the first time he asked me, I gave him a lame excuse and said, it's too early in the day, so you won't be able to see anything. But the truth of the matter is, I didn't know how to put the thing together, and I didn't want to embarrass myself. So finally, we get the telescope together, and I've never had a telescope before. And so I'm trying to pretend like I know what I'm doing so I can show him how to use the telescope. So we're looking in this thing, and it's foggy and it's blurry. And AJ, who's very inquisitive and who's very sharp, says to me, I think you are looking at it wrong. And actually, I was. I was looking in the wrong place. And so because of that, I wasn't able to get an accurate picture of the moon. Now, that relates a whole lot to preaching, because sometimes we can be looking at a text from the wrong lens and end up getting a blurry view. So what I plan to do in this session with you all is to take some time to unpack the significance of understanding the context of a passage. So to that end, I want to draw this picture. Text is at the center. Oh, and you have these circles on the outside. So the text is central to what we do. And outside of the text, there are circles that represent layers. Layers. I like to think of context as layers. So you have a passage, but there is also a layer around the passage, and we call that context. Now, the point I want to drive in this session is we must understand the context in order to understand how the original audience understood the context. So we must understand the context in order to understand how the original audience would have understood the text. If you don't do that, what ends up happening is you take a passage and you isolate it from the author's meaning. My grandfather was a pastor for many years, but he wasn't a Baptist pastor. He was a Pentecostal pastor, one of the strongest men I've ever met. But he was a Pentecostal pastor. I'm Baptist. And so he had a unique way of saying things sometimes. And when I started preaching, he communicated to me a principle that I've held dear in my time of preaching. He says, Ashton, when you take a text out of context, you end up conning the text. When you take a text out of context, you end up conning the text. And so we don't want to be con men as we handle the word of God. We want to view a text in light of its context so we can really understand how the original audience would have understood that. When you don't do that, you end up preaching flat sermons. So you take a passage, you lift it out of the context in which it was written, and then you create your own understanding of the passage that's not really grounded by the passage relation with other passages. Secondly, when you don't take into consideration the context of a passage, you're not properly situating yourself in the complete and full story of Scripture. And so remember, we believe that the Scripture is coherent and it's moving us toward an ultimate end. When you don't take in consideration the context, you're missing out on where this passage is situated in God's grand and redemptive story. What I want to ask you just for a moment is to sketch out for us as a group kind of some strategies, some concrete strategies that help us get at context. Just holler out at me. What are some strategies that help us discern and discover the context of a passage?
Read the word over and over again.
Okay, read the passage over and over again. Anybody else? Understand the history of the section of Scripture, the pericope. All right, anybody else?
Genre, like text type.
Right, genre, text type.
Read
what comes before and after your text. Good. All kind of good strategies that help us get at context. When we talk about context, it's a term of art because we're really talking about something that's very specific. And what we should take note of today is the different types of context, First, there is literary context. Literary context refers to the texts that are surrounding the text that is in question. So it is the text, the text before the text you're preaching and the text after the text you're preaching. So literary is the text before, the text after. Biblical context is how has this text been used by others before? So how do other have other authors use this text? It could be a biblical allusion. So you could be reading a passage in the New Testament that is a quotation from something in the Old Testament. So that type of citation or allusion would be considered a biblical context. And then historical context takes into account the original audience. So that deals with where the original audience is. It relates somewhat to setting, but predominantly it refers to how the original audience would have understood it. Then there's cultural context. Cultural context, as the word denotes, deals with the cultural setting of the particular passage, the cultural setting of a particular passage. Now, these things are weighed differently depending on the passage that you're preaching. So every passage may not have all of these elements readily available. So as you're working through your passages this week, the question about context, when you get to the question about context, think about which aspect of the context helps you understand the passage before you more clearly. So every passage may not have the biblical context. Every passage may not have the historical or cultural context, but it may have a literary context. So the literary context in that situation might be most helpful for you. As a group, we're going to work through some examples of this so that we can better understand how context works as we are preparing for our sermons. I want you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 5. 1 Samuel chapter 5. And we're going to be splitting you all up by tables, so one side of the table, other side of the table, and then these groups on the side. So from 1 Samuel 5, we're going to start kind of with a funny illustration. So as you're reading with the person next to you, we want you to come up with a title that completely misses the point of the passage. So a title that completely gets it wrong. So at this point, I don't want you to get into the technicals. I want you to read a passage that completes it, that completely gets it wrong, and work on it with the person next to you. All right. So we'll focus in back this way. And remember, this is supposed to be a fun exercise. We'll start with this table right here in front of us. Will somebody tell us what you all came up with for a title?
How to treat tumors.
How to treat tumors.
The tumor of idolatry.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. What about you all over here?
Philistines are the worst.
All right. Philistines are the worst. All right. Here.
I'm not sure. Raiders of the Lost
Ark. Wow. All right. You all here?
He said, don't lose your head.
Don't lose your head. All right. What about you all?
Follow your face for a blessing.
Follow your face for a blessing. All right. Kind of Pentecostal flavor. Anybody else?
Panic in the pandemic.
Panic in the pandemic. All right. Relevant. All right.
Keys to a better health and complexion.
Oh, wow. Keys to a better health and complexion. Gotcha. Anybody else want to share? Yep.
Watch out for God's back end.
Wow, watch out for God's back. That's good. That's good. All right, really, all of them are bad. So, what we're going to do now is look at this passage now in light of its context. So I want you to look at chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. Just quickly with your group and then report back to us what the context is. Only those verses, 4, 1 through 11. All right, anybody want to share with us the context? 1 through 11, just a brief summary statement. Yes, sir.
God refuses to be our lucky charm.
Okay, good. Good, good. Now, I want you to read verses 19 through the end of that passage. 19 through the end. All right. So, in light of verses 1 through 11 and 19 through the rest of the passage, what do we learn about chapter 5? So, we'll talk among the members of your group. And so now, since we've looked at the passage before, I want you all to discern what you think the meaning of chapter 5 is. All right, we'll start with this group. What does the passage mean in light of its context? Let's take a stab.
So we were kind of talking about how there's this kind of tension because there's a relationship between God's presence and power with the ark. That's real, but it's not something that people can then manipulate. So when Israel thinks they can manipulate it, they lose. But when the ark leaves, something real really has been lost. The glory has departed. But then when the Philistines think they've conquered the ark, God's power then is manifest in their destruction. So it's this kind of the context makes there's some complexity and depth. God's relationship with this ark and what it represents but he's not controlled.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Anybody I'd like to add?
God's presence departing from his people is devastating. God's presence with pagans is devastating. So you've got the need for God's presence with his people on his terms. But God's presence with those who are not his people is judgment.
That's good. Now, do you all see what reviewing the literary context did for your comprehension of that passage? So it's so important that you read the passages around your passage so that you're arriving at what the true meaning of the text is. So we're going to move now to some examples in the book that we're studying this week. So go ahead and turn to Judges. And I'm going to just have you all to start off looking in Judges chapter 1, verses 1 through 10. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 10. Very simple. Read it. Talk with the person next to you. And then we're going to ask you about historical context. Historical context. All right. We'll start with Frank's table. And then we'll go to Brian's table. Historical context.
In one sense, if you're looking at the historical context as far as the period of time, this is after the death of Joshua and what was going to happen. We had two leaders empowered by God.
All right. So in the historical event, Joshua is dead. All right.
So kind of coming from the perspective that the audience would be receiving the book of Judges, reading the book of Judges, is going to be the time of Samuel, kind of the perspective we're coming from. A few things stood out. And then Samuel preparing for a king, going on the book of Judges. Some things like Judah, and Judah's part to play here in the beginning, and the promise that the scepter never depart from Judah, those kingly concepts. Seeing how God repays cruel kings, like Adoni Bezek, who was cut off toes and thumbs, and as I've done, God, since God repaid me, they put in their mind, this is what God does to cruel kings, as they're preparing for a king in light of their failures.
Nice. Thank you. Anybody else on historical context? All right. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, we talked about this is a little bit of literary, but it's also putting it in the
context. Sure.
So my opinion, not just biblical, but we were talking about the relationship between the allotment and connecting it back so they understand what's going on in the life of Joshua.
Right. Right. So chapter 1, because of its placement, you have a mix of things happening, aspects of context there. You have historical, there's historical context, there's some biblical context there as well, and there's also some cultural context. And there's literary context because it's what? It's the first chapter, right? And so it sets the stage. So some passages we go to will have different elements of the various aspects of context at play. Now I'm going to have you to look at a passage now that we're not covering this week, but a passage that is in Judges that's often overlooked. So turn to Judges 3 and 31. 3 and 31. Now, this exercise will take a little longer because this is a passage, again, that we're not covering, but it's also a passage that most people probably haven't heard of or talked about. So I want you to look at Judges 3, 31, and examine it in light of its literary context. literary context. So this exercise may take just a tad bit longer. So I want you with your group to work through Judges 3:31 and arrive at the literary context of that passage. All right. Who'd like to take a stab at it? Before you do that, no pun intended. Before you do that, I want to say this passage, I know it wasn't assigned, but it kind of helps to give you some further insight about the book of Judges. So I wanted to kind of mix the passages in with the ones that we were doing and some of the ones that we are not able to get this week so that you could have a fuller understanding of the book of Judges. Who would like to? Yeah, right here.
I'll take a stab at it. I think some of the interesting things about the literary context is going, you have a story of Ehud before,
mm-hmm.
then Shamgar, and then after it goes back to Ehud. So, in most of the narratives, it's judge, judge's action, judge's death, maybe some peace in the land. But here, it's not Shamgar died and then something happened. He goes back up in the story to Ehud again, creating in a way that Shamgar is really a parenthesis. But like you, it's he gets some of the fewest details in the traditional judges cycle. It doesn't even say it's assumed that God raised him up. It doesn't say that in response to God's people cry, God raised up this deliverer. So there's interesting absence of information that I think it yields this moment where the parentheses is telling the reader God's working in more than one place and more than one way all at the same time. Especially when you, if you believe the kind of mapping of Ehud down here and Shamgar further north, and potentially the name not being Jewish, it's just this little parenthesis of God also did this. And now let's go back to Ehud and keep the line going.
Interesting. All right. That's good. No.
You said
no.
Interesting. You're not supposed to say interesting. You
said no. Oh. All right. Anybody else like to flow with that, riff off of that?
One thing that I've noticed in the flow is that the last verse of chapter, in verse 30, Israel took the Moabites subject to them. And then
verse 30 of which chapter?
Of chapter 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then chapter 4, verse 2, after it says that the Lord sold them to the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. I don't know what that means, but
there's
something
I don't know. Okay. All right.
You. Brother here pointed out, wanted me to talk, that if you look over in the Song of Deborah and Barak in 5-6, it talks about, so
right.
Deborah and Barak are singing, Deborah is singing here, so in the days of Shamgar, son of Anath in 5-6, in the days of Jael, the highways were abandoned. The travelers kept to the byways. The villagers ceased in Israel. They ceased to be until I arose. So it does seem that Shamgar is not providing the same kind of cycle of judgment and deliverance and rule like the other judges. Because Deborah is saying, but yet Deborah is acknowledging him, that he was present in these broken, difficult days, and to quote what I'm kind of reinforcing what our brother was saying, God still seems to be at work doing things even when he wasn't bringing out this kind of full cycle of deliverance and redemption. Because Deborah can sing about him, but recognize that he didn't bring the kind of deliverance that came through Deborah and Barak. So it seems like nothing's happening. Something's still happening.
Right. Good.
If we look at Shamgar, someone individual, I killed 600 people.
Yeah.
But the credit goes to the God of Israel. He also set Israel. So the point is, Shamgar is addressing the Philistines, not the Moabites. Another kind of people. But these are all in the middle of part of the history where the own people of Israel is rejecting the Lord.
But still, God is choosing people.
Nice.
And also us.
Okay. Well, here and then here and then back there.
I'm just curious, given the previous context that you gave us from 4 verses 1 through 10, what he pointed out with the God of the Zek, that God is has his hand in his dealing with unjust kings or unjust rulers, judges, then he also is prospering just rulers that seem to be kind of, because like Adonai said, you know, you don't really hear much of him, and Shamgar, you don't really hear much of him. So it's just God's hand continuously working even outside of the story, not both of those kind of coming together.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just want to say, it's kind of almost like a hint towards unlikely heroes. So Shamgar here, but then Deborah, when she's talking about Shamgar, she also talks about in the days of Jael. JL was the one that put the spike in Sizzler's hand. So it's almost like these unlikely heroes were people God was using along the way while the bigger story was playing out.
Hmm, that's good. And there was somebody back.
Yeah, I just, obviously, these are not fully formed thoughts in my mind. Just
sure.
If Shamgar is only mentioned by way of passing in brief detail by the author because he's setting up what the brother pointed out with Deborah and Barak, that the Song of Deborah references him. And so it's more important for the context of that coming up that he gives 2 chapters to, including the only poem like that in the book, as opposed to spending all our time then on this one verse of Shamgar.
Right.
It's more contextual for the author himself in explaining it, as opposed to wanting us to spend a ton of time in the details of it.
So the last thing I was going to have you all to do, and I'm running right on time, this is going to be brief, because I know most of you have already read this passage, because you had to read it in order to understand the Shamgar piece. And you brought it up. We were going to look at the song right there in chapter 5. I want you to just really briefly, because we have just a couple of minutes, unpack the context there of chapter 5. All of chapter 5 there. And I know we don't have a whole lot of time, but if you can just kind of speed through with the person next to you. And we're looking at literary context here.
I'm going to go to the next slide.
All right, we'll give you just another minute. All right. So we'll wrap up here just by getting the understanding of this last passage here. We have anybody want to volunteer what you discovered about the literary context?
We got a lot of guesses.
All right. And I know that was quick, and this is just what I'm trying to emphasize is the importance of knowing that the literary context is important. And so I know that you didn't have time fully to unpack every element contextually, but I did want you to just report what you've discovered. Yes, sir.
In chapter 1, it shows which tribes conquered and did what God said and which ones didn't. And then you come into the Song of Deborah. You know, here are the warriors who fought nobly, and here are the guys who, you know, they hung out and, you know, they weren't willing to engage in the battle. And even women acted more courageously than they. So it seems to be an indictment on the partial obedience of Israel, celebrating the faithfulness and the courage of those who did obey, but also challenging those who are, you know, on their white donkeys enjoying safety when it came at a high price.
Thanks. Thank you. What else? What do you discover during the literary context?
I'm going to take a shot at the dark. It seems almost as though the Song of Deborah
pointing out to the whole theme of how the judges want to play out. The people celebrate when good leaders are in place, then they fall, and then it's a deserted time, and then they cry out, and then somebody unlikely has to step up and then the people celebrate. It's almost like this, it feels almost like it's pointing out the whole cycle of how Israel's going to be throughout the cycle.
Okay. Okay. What about you all?
Well, we were, in terms of, we were also just still trying to think about Shamgar and how he fits into all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just seeing the literary pattern of what this kind of full cycle of the judge looks like and how it kind of comes to a kind of conclusion. So you have the pattern of sin, oppression, cry, deliver, and then the concludes verse 3:11. So the land had rest 40 years, that Othniel the son of Kenaz died. And then in 3:30, so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, the land had rest for 80 years. And at the end of 4, you don't have that, but then you do have it at the end of 5, and the land had rest for 40 years. So you've kind of got these full cycles that come in terms of having rest, and then, in ability to say, is Shamgar just another one of those guys who kind of just has a little mini cycle? But it seems like he doesn't have that cycle, and rather he's kind of embedded within the cycle that we see in 4 and 5, which just would cause us to reflect on, again, kind of God continuing to be at work in various kinds of individuals, providing relief, even if it's not kind of the full definitive cycle of deliverance and rest, still at work.
Nice.
I think somebody pointed out how he was right beside JL in that song, and I think putting them together, they're both unexpected. JL, she's a woman, and then Shamgar, because of his identification with that pagan god, and kind of saying, in both situations, God is protecting his people through very unexpected means.
Hmm. Thank you, brother. Here and then back there.
I go along with what Aaron was saying. I'm still confused why Shamgar is to be considered a judge. Why? What is the rule of determining that? Other than all the study Bibles I've seen and I've read in commentaries, I've sort of it's contested whether or not Shamgar actually should be considered one of the judges, because there isn't that same literary cycle there, and it does seem that it is more consistent with an assistant role like JL is to Deborah's.
So the scholarship is mixed around that, but predominantly he's listed. But there are some commentaries who look at him as a judge type or deliverer type, but not fully. But that's a minority view. So,
the reason we ask that is because verse 6 says, in the days of Shamgar and the days of Jael.
Verse 6 of which chapter?
Chapter 5.
Gotcha.
Over covering.
Yeah.
Verse 6, Shamgar and Jael. And then nothing's really happening until Deborah arrives in verse 7.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a good question. It's a good question.
We were just talking about some of the dangers of reading this poem out of context. I mean, it's a rather strange poem to read about most blessed of women who shatters and pierces the temple, his skull.
Right.
And you could read that out of context and be, you think it's immoral, what she does. Well, then you understand the context of who Sisera was in chapter 4, verse 3. He oppressed them cruelly for 20 years. And you go from being revolted by what she's done to rejoicing along with them for the deliverance that it was.
Right.
So,
and
in context, it totally changed your
world. Yes.
The framework.
Yes. And, yeah.
And along with that, God pierces Egypt and crushes Egypt to bring his people out of that oppression. And then they sing a song on the other side of the Red Sea to remember
his
mighty deliverance. So you've got a song after a deliverance in order to remember what God has done. And that seems to be a unique thing about this psalm in this book, is that it's a way for the God's people to remember his deliverance when they haven't remembered it for several cycles.
and they're not going to remember it for a number of cycles beyond.
Right. So there are a lot of echoes with Exodus 15. Also, to your point, that's what I was driving at with the story. That when you read the judge's story, it's so important that you have literary context in mind, or else this is like the worst thing to preach ever. So you have literary context to kind of, and historical context to let you know what's happening and why these certain actions, why certain actions are being pursued. They begin to make a little bit more sense when you look at what God is requesting and what happens in light of the context. There was one last person.
Yes. Yep. So kind of going back to what Aaron said earlier, God's plan is always going to happen. There's no question about that. He's going to achieve his goal. And we are blessed with the opportunity to be a part of that in certain ways. And I think Deborah is kind of calling out the people and saying, guys, y'all had the opportunity to be a part of this, and y'all weren't. Why not? Like, God's goal was still achieved, but you could have been a part of this, and you could have gotten to share in God's glory in this. And it kind of reminded me, my wife might side-eye me a little bit about making this comparison, but it reminded me of the passage that says, even the rocks will cry out if men are silent. And so you've got God using other means to achieve the goal that he had for his people when his people didn't stand up. So just an interesting comparison.
Thank you. I'm out of time. Thank you.